It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferris.
And I'm Veronica Rickert, and you're with us on the Ideas Network. Coming up, new research shows that our galaxy may reside in a massive cosmic void. We'll learn what that could mean in a little bit.
First, the University of Wisconsin System regents have been meeting this week to hammer out the details of the 2017-2018 operating budget. Among the decisions, a vote to give more money to smaller campuses in the state.
Also, the regents opted to set what they called a guidepost for free speech on campuses. This comes as many state lawmakers want to pass a law that would punish students who disrupt speakers that they disagree with on campus.
Karen Herzog joins us now. She's the higher education reporter for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. Karen, welcome back to Central Time.
Thank you, Rob.
Well, let's look at this. It's a little bit of a new pocket of money here for the UW system, right? Can you talk about what the state is looking at giving the UW system and the money at play in this decision they made this week?
Well, the funding that was approved by the Joint Finance Committee, and again, this is a preliminary part of the process. The full legislature and the governor still need to sign off on this, but the Joint Finance Committee approved $25 million in new money for the UW system that would specifically be divided among campuses for various initiatives, expenses. And there's a new formula that actually was used the last time this happened in the previous budget when there was $25 million to be distributed. That formula favors the smaller campuses. UW-Madison, under traditional distribution of money, gets the lion's share, and it continues to get the lion's share. However, in this case, UW-Milwaukee got the most, and Madison got less, and some of the other campuses got more than they normally would, which has created a backlash among supporters of UW-Madison.
And this is something that was supported by almost all the regents. What was the argument in favor of allocating this money in a formula that gives proportionally less to UW-Madison?
Well, it's all about need and the impact of past budget cuts. The several campuses don't have very many non-resident students. They don't have international students. They don't have professional schools. Madison has all three in great numbers. And that is viewed as an alternative revenue source that gives Madison a big advantage. So it's looked at as a way to sort of even the playing field, in a sense, for the budget cuts. However, UW-Madison sees it as the flagship has taken the largest share of the past budget cuts. And now there's concern that this formula for dividing one-time money is changing, and that, you know, the success that Madison has had is being held against it, and that is pitting campuses against each other as they scramble to get the most money they can from the state.
On some of the smaller campuses, the argument is that the cuts that have come in recent years to the overall system, they've taken their share of those, and that's really, they've had to do some serious changes and cutbacks in staffing and other spending. Is that right?
That's right. The smaller campuses don't have something else that UW-Madison has a larger share of, and that's, but well, keep in mind, Madison also has higher costs and a higher ability to keep faculty that are leaving because of budget issues. But the smaller campuses don't have the ability to raise all of this money, and they have had to cut faculty. And there's a lot of concern that they're having trouble managing with what they have, and there doesn't appear to be any big funding increases in the future for the UW system. So it's a continued effect of not being able to recover from those cuts and not getting big help otherwise.
Now, this is an argument over $25 million. How does that stack up compared to the whole UW system budget?
Well, the whole UW system budget is actually $6.2 billion. And it's probably important to note that UW-Madison still gets the rest of its state funding allocation under the standard formula. So it's not getting a funding cut. UW-Madison, in this case, its operating budget, its base budget, is still going to increase by $69.7 million. And then if you look at just tuition and state funding together, of course, tuition is a big growth area for UW-Madison. The flagship will gain 5.7% in funding. So it's important to be clear that this is not cutting UW-Madison. It's just changing the way in which additional new money is divided among campuses.
Talking to Karen Herzog from the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel, looking at some recent decisions this week from UW Regents as they get ready for a new budget picture. Also, on the staying on the money side of things, Karen, the Regents decided to raise student fees. There's this tuition freeze, of course, but fees can go up some. What is included in that?
Well, all the campuses have student fees that students pay for things like, you know, student government, activities that like student organizations, use of the student union, recreation, and all of those things, plus their housing costs. So when you add it all up, the fees that are going up for housing, the student seg fees, they're called seg fees, and also like meal plans, we're seeing some increases that are, some would say, are hidden, because we always talk about tuition. For example, at Madison, the total increase between seg fees, room rates, and meal plan is $321. And those costs together, if keep that in mind, that this is increasing the total cost of college. A year of being at UW-Madison for undergrads is $19,562 for the next fiscal year.
And did these fees go up similar amounts on different campuses, or is there a range of changes?
There is a range. That's a really good point. And it varies by type of fee. Seg fees also support, like if there are students that, or excuse me, if there are campuses that are building new unions and recreation facilities, that's where that money comes in. The students are paying for those things, and those are approved by students on a pretty small margin of votes. They actually have referendums, but few students participate. And so they're basically committing future students to pay the debt on those buildings that they're approving. Those future students are going to be paying for the next 30 years, long after they're gone.
And then the Regents tackle an issue that's been in the news, controversial. There's been an effort in the state legislature to have what they're calling, in some cases, free speech guidelines that would punish students who interrupt speakers on campus. Their goal to keep intellectual diversity on campus. The Regents had their own take on something like this. What did they come up with?
Well, the Regents policy, it's not really policy. It's called, they refer to it as a guidepost. And it doesn't impose penalties, as what some lawmakers would like to see. It basically says, here's what we want our campuses to do. We want them to be alert to honor opposing views and promote a civil discourse. So all of the things that the legislature is talking about, expelling, you know, suspending students who are repeat offenders, none of those things are in that guidepost. However, there are separate rules, there's separate, actually, UW system policies within state statute that lay out possible penalties for students who are disruptive repeatedly in protests and that kind of thing. So the Regents would say those things already are in their policies, and they don't need to add them in this guidepost, that this is simply restating their belief of the importance of free expression on campuses.
And where is this proposal from the legislature in the legislative process?
Well, the Assembly passed this bill it's the first piece of this, passed it on a party line vote last month. I believe it was a 61-36 party line vote, no Democrats in favor. The Senate hasn't committed to a timeline for taking up a measure there, and Governor Walker has said that he's receptive to the idea, so we're looking at several months down the road. And I did get a statement from Assembly Speaker Robin Voss today saying that what the Regents did really wasn't enough, that they really feel like there needs to be, within policy on academic freedom, those penalties for students who repeatedly disrupt campus speakers.
And while we can't predict for sure, but is there any indication that the Senate is maybe going to take this up, or might be persuaded by what the UW Regents did this week, that they don't need to follow up on what the Assembly did?
It's going to be interesting to watch. I don't know if it will resurface because, again, there's been no commitment to pick it up, although I think the pressure will continue among GOP lawmakers to address this in the way that they think is most important for preserving conservative voices on campus. This is an issue that's not going to go away.
Karen, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you, Rob.
That's Karen Herzog, higher education reporter for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. She joined us today for a look at decisions made at this week's UW Regents meetings.
Right now, our universe is a big, cold, and virtually empty place. Even in our own solar system, the sun is nearly 93 million miles away. Beyond the sun, the nearest galaxy to us is the Andromeda Galaxy, and that's 2.5 million light years away. In layman's terms, pretty far.
And while we know that the universe is a big place, new research shows that parts of the universe are more densely populated than others. That means on the flip side, some areas are downright empty, and that research shows that our own Milky Way galaxy may be in the middle of a cosmic void.
David Eicher is with us now to tell us more. He's the editor-in-chief of Astronomy Magazine. David, welcome back to Central Time.
Well, thanks. Thanks for having me. How are you?
Doing pretty well and still trying to get my mind around this cosmic void thing. What is a cosmic void?
Cosmic Swiss cheese. So we live in a universe filled with at least 100 billion galaxies. It is an enormously, unbelievably large place, of course. The visible universe that we know of is at least 93 billion light years across, and it may be much larger than that, likely. So there's a lot of stuff in it, but the space is really, really large, and parts of the universe at a really large scale are much denser than others, and this is what this study is talking about. Where our galaxy and the groups of galaxies and even the clusters and superclusters around us lie in the universe, we may be in a fairly low-density part locally, but we don't know that yet. That's one possible explanation from this study that is recently out of the University of Wisconsin.
So you mentioned cosmic Swiss cheese. So, you know, obviously we're getting as lots of holes in it there. If you were to draw a pretty crude representation of this, is that what the universe looks like? That there's a lot more space and then just is clusters of things here and there?
There are clusters of galaxies and so-called superclusters, strings of clusters of galaxies, but it's not quite as simple as Swiss cheese because the low-density places still have lots of stuff in them, and we may well, as you talked about, be in one of those, but we still have in our little local group of galaxies, about 54 galaxies at least, in our Virgo cluster of galaxies that's very close to us, just a few tens of millions of light years, about 1,300 galaxies, and in the Laniakea cluster that's within this bubble, we still have about 100,000 galaxies. So that's a low-density region of space, and it still has about 100,000 galaxies in it. We're not super lonely and all alone here.
So how does this play out elsewhere? You said we don't really know for sure, but what does this mean about the way the universe could be structured or the way space is structured?
Good question. We know that there are denser and less dense portions, but this study, which is by Amy Barger and her colleagues at Wisconsin, has looked at the differences in what astronomers call the Hubble constant, and that's the expansion rate of the universe. And the differences near us and with very, very distant exploding stars suggest that maybe there's less material near us than in the more distant universe. That's the supposition. We really don't know that this is true absolutely yet, but it would explain some things if it is true. It also doesn't account for the wild card of dark energy, which is this force that's pushing the expansion of the universe apart to be faster as you go farther away. So we really don't know the answer to this yet. It's likely that we have a lower density universe locally here, but we're not sure.
And about this dark energy, I mean, do we know if that's, so can we at least surmise that that is what's pushing and pulling areas of density, high density and low density apart or maybe together?
It very well might be. And again, we're not, this is something that is on the frontier, and we're really not, astronomers are not sure yet. It was discovered in 1998 when distant exploding stars were moving away faster than they should be to account for the expansion of the universe from the Big Bang. This is a repulsive force that pushes the expansion of the universe. And we really don't know what this is yet at all, the nature of dark energy. The really disturbing thing, if you want to lie awake at night here, is that of the mass and energy of the universe, of course, mass and energy are the same thing in interconvertible forms. about two-thirds of the mass energy of the universe is in this form of dark energy, and we have no idea what it is as yet. So if somebody wants to win a Nobel Prize, that figuring this out is a certain way to do it.
Now, I've heard the term dark matter a lot. Is this something distinct, or are these the same things?
It is distinct. Now, dark matter is a lesser, is about 26% of the mass and energy of the universe. We don't really know what dark matter is yet either, although we can see its effects. And it's probably some kind of dark elementary particle, but we haven't discovered it yet in things like the Large Hadron Collider, CERN. That's probably a particle, and it's hypothetically been called the axion, that something like this particle would explain dark matter that we can see the effects of in galaxies. But if you take dark energy and add it to dark matter, and then you have about 4% and a little bit more of the stuff in the universe is the bright material that includes galaxies and stars and planets and cats and dogs and trees and humans. That's the stuff that we're made out of, the normal so-called baryonic matter. It's only about 4% of the stuff in the universe, and we understand it and not much else.
So you're telling me we only understand 4% of the universe. The rest we have no idea.
We have an idea, but we don't know for sure what they are yet. And so astronomers are not going to be out of work anytime soon.
Interesting. Well, going back to the universe as a cosmic void, which is what we're discussing today, this idea of big empty expanses and then clusters of galaxies and things like that, like the Milky Way, which is this new research from UW-Madison and other places. So do we know what might attract these clusters to form clusters in the first place? Why aren't things kind of spread out equidistant?
Yes, that's a good question. And if you go to really, really large scales, things in the universe are pretty evenly distributed. But as you go to smaller and smaller and smaller scales, you see the effects of gravity more and more and more. So things that are, you mentioned the Andromeda Galaxy, things that are close to each other are not necessarily all moving apart from each other because gravity is acting on them. In about 4 billion years or so, the Milky Way and the Andromeda Galaxy, in fact, which is moving toward us, will merge into a single super galaxy that astronomers call Milkomeda.
No, so, and that's not going to happen in the next 50 years.
You don't have to lose any sleep over that, but it's going to be a tremendous spectacle when these galaxies come together and merge.
Wow.
That'll be a long time from now. But so gravity acts on fairly small distant scales like that, but at large scales, things are much more spread out, and there are these relative holes and rich areas of galaxies.
Now, Wired magazine was writing about this subject of the cosmic void idea and saying that it's possible that the Milky Way where we are could be at the center of this cosmic void, which kind of puts us in a strange place. Can you talk more about that?
Yes, that's right. And if this study by Amy and others at Wisconsin is true, we would be in a very low density near the center of this sort of bubble, this hole, if you will, a hole in the Swiss cheese that's maybe about a billion light years across. So that's a huge amount of space with lots of galaxies in it, as I said, but lower density, smaller number of galaxies than the areas around us that are beyond about a billion light years. So it's not like it's completely empty, but we're in a relatively poor, quiet area of our region of space. That's actually a pretty good thing because we're also kind of out in the fringe of our Milky Way, just looking at our galaxy itself, and that keeps us away from the center where there's a lot of danger. There's a supermassive black hole, there's antimatter, there's all kinds of bad stuff going on in the center of our galaxy. It's good to be out in the quiet suburbs, and this may also be the case with our on a very large scale, as they found now, too.
As a scientist, though, who wants to learn more, does that mean it's harder to get data about the observable and the unobservable universe?
It's always a challenge, and you know, we're really in a golden age here in terms of astronomical research. We know so much more about galaxies than we did just 10 or 20 years ago. It's really an incredible renaissance that's going on, and the instruments that exist now, the Hubble Space Telescope, the James Webb Space Telescope that will launch next year. These are making these questions easier for astronomers to answer despite these bubbles and voids. It may be that the Webb Space Telescope can look back in time and see the first galaxies that formed very early in the universe, and then we'll understand how galaxies evolved over time much better to be where we are, say, in the modern universe today.
Why is this renaissance happening in astronomy right now? What's special about this period of time?
The instruments have really gotten to be tremendous. And, you know, knowledge builds on knowledge. So we didn't even understand what galaxies were at all, for example, until 1923. Edwin Hubble discovered the nature of galaxies and that the universe was expanding a few years later. But we really didn't understand the structure of our Milky Way until just a few years ago, that it's a barred spiral and many of the galaxies that are around us in very much detail. And it's largely because more astronomers are working on the knowledge that has come before, but also that the telescopes in orbit and the ground-based big telescopes are much, much better than they were a decade ago.
And David, we've just got a little bit of time left, but what big things are on the horizon, so to speak, here in astronomy?
Oh, boy, there are things going on all over the place. There's back on Earth here, in the United States, we have a really great solar eclipse that's coming next month, August 21st, that will cut all the way across the United States, a path of totality, the most widely visible one in about 100 years. But there's lots of stuff going on in terms of science research with galaxies and all sorts of other things. The Cassini spacecraft is going to plummet and end its mission down into the atmosphere of Saturn here in a couple of months now in the fall. That's a really exciting thing that's going on with planetary science. The New Horizons mission, you remember a couple of years ago, flew past Pluto. That's going to go out and look at a Kuiper Belt object, a distant rocky object way, way out there.
A lot to look forward to. Wow, David, thank you so much for joining us.
You bet.
David Eicher is editor-in-chief of Astronomy Magazine, and he joined us today to talk about some new research from the UW-Madison that shows that our galaxy may reside in a massive cosmic void.
Food Friday is coming up next here on Central Time. First, some of the world's most vibrant and flavorful food can be found in India. And the seemingly endless variety of spices and seasoning used in Indian food means that those of us in the kitchen can unleash our creative side.
But traditional Indian dishes can be heavy on ingredients that are low in fiber and sometimes high in carbohydrates. Our next guest reimagined the food of her homeland by substituting healthier options and preserving the flavors that she grew up with.
Deepa Thomas joins us now. She was born and raised in New Delhi and is the author of Deepa's Secrets, Slow Carb, New Indian Cuisine. Deepa, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you, Rob. I'm delighted to be here.
Well, you say, you make no secret that your food, your cooking is inauthentic in some ways when it comes to Indian food. What is different from traditional dishes that you've changed in your cooking?
I could say everything, but that wouldn't be correct. And it's exactly what you just said. How could I make this simpler? It's an ode, homage to my American life, two American sons who now like to cook. And I had to make it easier. And all that came to a head when my husband was diagnosed with type 2 diabetes. And none of us, I wish I could tell you that I invented new Indian cuisine the day he was diagnosed, but I'm not that devout a wife. it took me a few years and a lot of changes. And it's simpler, delicious, easy to make, understandable, accessible, and most of all, healthy.
And one of your first responses when you were dealing with this diabetes diagnosis was, oh my gosh, the rice. You know, there's rice in so much of Indian food, and then you have the naans. It must have been, at least in the beginning, kind of challenging to figure out how you were going to rework this so that you could take some of those carbs out and do sort of slow absorbing carbohydrates instead.
Yeah, it was a big jolt, a reality check. But then again, I've been a rule breaker all my life, so it was easy to take a left turn. I applied the same principles that I took in my career of going left when the whole pack went right. And I'd be happy to tell you more about that.
Yeah, what kind of changes were key to making the Indian food with the flavors that you loved and that your family loved, but having a healthier stuff that would be good for somebody, say, with type 2 diabetes?
Yeah. First of all, I think we'll all agree that mouth feel and familiarity guide what our preferences might be in food. So I didn't compromise on flavor at all. In fact, if I took an overly refined food out or a carbohydrate out, my rule was to bump up the flavor. And as long as you did that, you likely would be able to achieve what people call Indian food. But Indian food, like every cuisine, is influenced by borderless techniques, I like to call them. We're all influenced by global cuisine, and I took advantage of the fact that I have had the great pleasure of dining in some of the best restaurants and learning at the elbows of some incredible chefs, even Michelin star chefs.
And in terms of the flavor profile, what stays the same? We've been talking about what changed, but what did you keep?
So important to know that seeds and spices are not just flavor boosters, but they are health ingredients. So seeds, simply put, and easy to understand, bear the promise of life, as we all know. And it's packed with micronutrients. And I tend to enjoy infusing my oils that I should cook in and make sure they're unrefined. And generally, I prefer unrefined coconut oil or olive oil or sesame seed oil, but infuse it with spices and herbs so that anything else you do to it, say you were to caramelize onions on top of it, it's already creating layers of flavor. And so I didn't take any of the flavor boosters out, just the refined carbs and any refined carbs, grains included, rice included.
A big part of the flavor in your dishes comes down to, I think, one piece of advice. There are lots of curry powder mixes on the market in the stores, and you say, don't buy them. Make your own.
Yeah, that's absolutely true, because any spice blend, and this goes beyond curry powder, which is a mythical name for something I think the Brits created when they came to India. But that aside, let's not blame them for everything. But any spices or spice mixes left on the shelf for long will be closer to sawdust than the flavors you want. And it's best to keep whole spices, seeds, toast them and grind them up. And so I give my signature curry powder recipe. I think every kitchen in India has its own signature. And mine is an easier, simpler, flavorful version that you can use for other, any recipe that calls for curry powder.
We're talking with Deepa Thomas right now. She's the author of the book, Deepa's Secrets, Slow Carb, New Indian Cuisine. And you also point out that your dishes, you don't want to call them diet food. You say that, and they're slow carb, you say, not no carb. Can you talk about that a little bit, about what a slow carb is and what they do for our bodies?
Yes. There is a distinction, because no carb is the word no. There's nothing allowed. Mine, it focuses on how long a food takes to convert to sugar. And all foods convert to sugar in the end. And the longer it takes, the healthier it is for you. So if a food has more fiber, it becomes slower for it to get absorbed. And that's a good thing. So slow carb likely has more fiber in the carbohydrate and slows down the digestion. So that aids your body. Otherwise, it just quickly converts to, it converts to energy, but then unused energy converts to fat.
Now, I got to ask, this is a debate I've had myself as a parent and a cook over the years. I have a hard time getting my kids to eat anything but slow carbs in the carb family. So they love plain pasta, white bread, white rice. I have trouble getting whole grain stuff, quinoa, barley you have in the book. How do you sell those to kids?
Very good question. Do it slowly. No sudden moves when it comes to kids. I think introducing the layered flavors from my book even if you let them eat whatever it is that they're eating. So if they like pasta, don't cut it off in an instant. You find, I don't know if you can find where you are, but definitely where we are, we get pastas made from whole grains. And that's different than the pretend whole grains on supermarket shelves, which have already taken the bran out and, you know, it's dead food. But if you can get small manufacturers of grain, they will, you know, that's look for pastas that are made from that. And in time, focus on the mouthfeel. So if you were to switch out a simple carb for a slow carb, and you might introduce a whole grain, make sure it's nice and goopy. You know, you can make lovely sauces. I bet if you made a sauce with browned shallots and some garlic and used coconut milk instead of cream, and herbs like, you know, their favorites, it could be thyme, it could be anything that they like, and slowly introduce that would be my suggestion.
I want to get to some of the recipes that you shared with us, and you've included a dal recipe. Now, dal, it seems like, can be simple if it's made to be, but dals can also be incredibly complex and have incredibly long laundry lists of ingredients. And yours, it strikes a nice balance, but you do call it, you give a nod, and you say dal for dummies. That's what you call this one. So it's not intimidating.
You must forgive me.
Yeah, tell us about your dal.
Well, I think the simpler the better. And there's a particular kind of dal that I recommend highly if it's possible to get. It's chana dal. And they say in India, it's the secret of North Indian women for staying slim. It's high fiber. And you find it in most, now even in supermarkets, but you can certainly get it online or an Indian grocery store. Keep it on hand and don't overcook it. That's another secret. It make your body work. I think dals in restaurants are sometimes overcooked and you just get a goopy mush. I like some texture al dente and lightly flavored. Again, there's a trick at the end, which I have called tadka. And tadka is essential to Indian cooking of various kinds. It's a sort of topping, but it's also a final flourish where you're heating some oil, whatever your favorite oil is. Hopefully it's not refined. And then it could be mustard seeds and shallots and curry leaf. And it's an instant sprinkling. Keep a lid handy because things will splutter. And that, as soon as it splutters, is done, and you top the dal with it. So it just gives this yummy, and the recipe is pretty clear. And mine is on the lighter version, but, you know, try it. And I'd love to hear from you once you've tried it.
And we're talking right now with Deepa Thomas, author of Deepa's Secret, Slow Carb, New Indian Cuisine, about reimagining the dishes of her homeland in a healthier way. And by the way, you can find that recipe for Dal for Dummies and a couple others over on the Central Time Facebook page.
And you can join the conversation at 800-642-1234. Do you have questions about preparing Indian food? Have you taken some of your favorite meals, Indian or otherwise, and made them healthier in ways like Deepa is talking about? Do you have diabetes or cook for someone who does? What kind of changes have you made in your cooking? And if you love Indian food, do you have some secrets of your own, some favorite dishes? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also post and find those recipes on the Central Time Facebook page.
We'll pick up our conversation in just a bit here on Central Time.
You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickard. And right now we're picking up our conversation with Deepa Thomas. And she's talking with us about reworking the dishes of her native India to include healthier, slow-carb ingredients.
You can join this Food Friday conversation at 800-642-1234 with your questions, maybe your own advice. Are you interested in trying out some Indian-style cooking but need a little bit of advice? If you make Indian food, what are some of your secret ingredients or favorite meals? And for any kind of cooking, have you tried making your food healthier by substituting maybe for those simple grains, the white rice, the white bread sorts of things, and including higher fiber, slow carb ingredients? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. or post on the Central Time Facebook page and find some of our guest recipes while you're there.
And Deepa, I don't know what the weather's like where you are, I think in the Bay Area, but here in Wisconsin in the South, it's been kind of hot, and you've got a great recipe, which I think would be a little cooling but still savory. It is a yogurt salad. It's Chukwu's yogurt salad combining yogurt and then some savory flavors, too. Can you tell us how that one comes together?
Yeah, this is a great standby, and usually in addition to any menu that I make for a dinner party. And it's fundamentally, when you look at the recipe, it's flavoring the yogurt with subtle spices and fresh herbs, and then topping it, and that's the made-up portion. And I give Chukwu. Chukwu is a dear family friend of many years. I think when I first met her, I was probably 10 years old, and she just recently visited me in San Francisco and chuckled that she'd better learn her own recipe after looking at what I wrote up. So it's the eggplant shards, if you will, cut up in small pieces and toasted in just a little oil. It's not greasy, but it's the balance between the flavored yogurt and the slight kick of the crisp eggplant that makes this yogurt salad delicious.
And it seems like this is something that would be pretty easy to do substitutions for. You could play with other vegetables, maybe things that are seasonal for that time of year.
In fact, I encourage it. I call that off-booking. And since I learned to cook in America and scorched the first meal I made, here I sit trying to be an authority on Indian food. Anyone can do this. Yes, please, substitute.
And you write about some of your inspiration, including visiting the pantry, I think it was, of your grandmother, seeing what was in there. And I wonder if you could inspire us about what we should have on hand in our own pantry so that we can put some of this type of food together.
Oh, I'll try to do that. And I think, like anything, if we get a little time put away up front to organize things, it becomes easier when you're under pressure. So coming home tired at the end of a long day is not a good time to think about what we should cook for dinner. I encourage a little thought, and therefore dedicate, I think it's page 22 in my book, what to keep in the storeroom. But my grandmother, who I lovingly called Mama, my father's mother, whose name I carry, aside from Deepa, my name is Elizabeth, and that was her name, but she was called Mama, and she was somebody who had to make a life out of thin air. She lived on a farm, and if she didn't grow it, she didn't have it. So she had to go way beyond what I needed to do to dry things and store things, and her storeroom was a kid's paradise as far as I can remember. And I talk about everything from mango bark that she dried in the sun from some 400 different varieties of mangoes that India has. She probably had about 100 plus varieties in her garden that her husband would, my grandfather would be very happy for me to point to one and cut it. And I mean, there are so many happy memories, but the most fun was jars and jars of wonderful smelling herbs and cardamom and clove and pepper. But one time there was a overturned basket, I should say. And when I went to move it, I could hear this little rustling sound. And there were a brood of chicks she was hatching and had hatched under there, scampering all over the storeroom. And you could just only imagine the joy for a little child.
We're talking.
So take some time and just look at the suggestions I make and then decide what you want and can afford, and a little planning and a little prep ahead of time will go a long way.
Talking to Deepa Thomas, her new book is Deepa's Secrets, Slow Carb New Indian Cuisine. And staying in the pantry for a minute, ducklings or no, encourage us to do something that I've started doing thanks to a previous Food Friday guest, using more spices in seed form, so like cumin seed or coriander seed, and grinding that right on the scene instead of buying it powdered. How much of a difference does that make?
It makes a tremendous difference, Rob, especially if you take the time to dry toast them in a pan. Be careful not to burn them. But anything that is toasted, coriander seed especially, it just comes to life. Cumin seed has a wonderful smoky flavor if you will toast it a little bit. So I encourage toasting of seeds before grinding. And then if you're going to grind it, you know, designate a coffee grinder or a specific grinder. Nothing worse than using your spice grinder for coffee the next morning.
You say at one point, Deepa, use grains that your grandmother would recognize. And so one of the sums you do for white rice is farro or farai. I can never remember how to pronounce that one. But can you tell us about that recipe?
Yes. You know, and we think farro, I think that's a pronunciation, but it was found apparently in the tombs of the pharaohs. So I don't know if farro came from pharaoh, but it's as old as the pharaohs. But everything old is new again, and it's so high fashion to have farro today. But farro has a wonderful texture, and it can be... See, all these grains have something in common. Depending on how long you cook them, it can be al dente or it can be mush. And I tend to prefer the al dente side of things. And so anything you might do to a pilaf, you could do to a farro. That's a fundamental principle. And then you can layer it with, you know, when it's you've got crunchy seeds in them, you might try some dried fruit or something that you enjoy, fresh cilantro and shallot or lemon rind or lemon zest. Or, you know, it's like, for me as a painter, I liken it to painting. You've got all these paints. Now it's up to you what you paint. And you can save any dish is my motto, except if you burn garlic, in which case, just quietly throw it out and start again.
Now, for somebody who maybe hasn't tried cooking Indian food or Indian-style food in the past, how would you encourage them to get started?
Oh, I think breakfast for any meal would be a good way to think. In our home, you might find one evening... a wonderful masala omelette, which I have a recipe for, with some sautéed vegetables. And the sautéed vegetables would simply have a few Indian spices or herbs. A sprinkle of chaat masala at the end would make it very Indian and hip. So start easy, experiment. Don't be afraid to experiment is what I'd say. And remember that these seeds and spices are 3,000 years old and certainly had their roots in Ayurveda, which is the science of plant-based medicine. And we now know conclusively that illness starts in the gut. And so the question is, these ancient spices from India were focused on how to keep your digestive tract healthy. And when it's healthy, it's happy, and you are happy. So start anywhere. Don't be afraid to experiment.
And you added one last recipe for us. It's called Tamji Spicy Kerala Beef with Coconut Chips. In about 20 seconds, Deepa, can you describe what you love about this one?
Well, I think it's the flavor... you don't expect beef to have these incredible surprises of coconut chips or the deep-throated flavors of coriander and curry leaf. And if you just follow my recipe, I think you'll get to a place. And of course, did I say I was a rule breaker? People would roll their eyes when I suggest Kobe beef for this meal, but it's an homage to my big brother who I love.
Deepa, thank you so much for joining us today.
It's a pleasure. Thank you for having me on.
That was Deepa Thomas, author of Deepa's Secrets, Slow Carb, New Indian Cuisine. Royalties from the book, by the way, benefit Food Corps, a national organization working to connect students with healthy food in schools. And if you have more thoughts on Indian cooking, you can tell us about them on the Central Time Facebook page and check out the recipes we've been talking about, including Dal for Dummies. That's on the Central Time Facebook page. If you love the groundbreaking children's book, Where the Wild Things Are, you'll be psyched to hear that a new work by Maurice Sendak was just discovered.
Sendak died in 2012, but the president of the Maurice Sendak Foundation just found a new story co-written by Maurice Sendak and his files.
The story is called Presto and Zesto in Limbo Land. It was co-written by Sendak and his friend, the writer and theater director, Arthur Yorinks. It tells the story of two friends who go for a walk and end up in, you guessed it, Limbo Land.
Presto and Zesto, by the way, were the nicknames that Sendak and Yorinks had for each other. And Sendak isn't just an incredible writer. He's also incredibly eloquent when it comes to talking about his favorite subject.
I have total trust in children, complete and total trust in children, and their incredible awareness of life, which is much keener and sharper. They are the little fawns who have to get up and run. And they have to know how to do that. And we must help them by telling them the truth.
Maurice Sendak there in a past interview on To the Best of Our Knowledge. So this book will be published. Are you going to go out and buy it when it comes out?
I think I might. You know, my daughter is still at that age where she likes picture books, and his illustrations are always just such a joy to look at. They have so much life.
So more Maurice Sendak to come. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network.